Hello, my dear art lovers. Today I present you my conversation with Dr. Ken Thurbeck, who is a real great of the New York art market. We talk about the evolution of art, how got art itself to an investment product, and we also talk about its value and performance. Check something about Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst's art and how they serve the art market. Furthermore, Ken criticizes Joseph Beuys' well-known quote, "Everyone is an artist," and he dares a little comparison between Beuys and Andy Warhol. Furthermore, we learn the super exciting story of Leonardo da Vinci's painting Salvator Mundi before it got sold for $450 million at auction, and we learn how Ken was involved in this story. We also talk about fake art and get Ken's thoughts on the booming NFT market where Madonna also tried to work with people, unfortunately not very successfully. And we learn what Mark Zuckerberg has to do with an online assault. Be curious to see what else we discuss. I have already recorded this conversation at the end of May. How is the art scene ticking? Everything we always wanted to know about art. This is the podcast of Petra Lossen. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Petra. How are you today?
I'm very fine, thank you. And how are you in New York?
I'm great. It's going to be a very hot day here today.
Oh, fantastic. I cannot say that for Switzerland. It's a bit fresh.
Fresh.
Ken, yeah, you've been a force in the art world for four decades, and you have sold art. You've been a partner of a New York art gallery. You advised clients on build their collections, and you have produced art and exhibited internationally. Your works are collected by the Museum of Modern Art at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, the Walker Art Center, the Stedelijk Museum. Is this right?
Stedelijk Museum in Holland, Amsterdam.
And the Polaroid Collection and others. And you continue to explore ways to engage and challenge, most recently working with a group of developers to produce a software application to launch NFTs on the Solana and Ethereum blockchain using Bitcoin. But let's start in the beginning, Ken. How did you get into art?
My family was very involved in art. And interestingly enough, when I was quite young, I'm a Canadian, one of the insurance companies in Canada was doing a tour of Van Gogh, and which was really interesting because what they were doing is that they were bringing a Van Gogh collection and putting it in different offices across Canada and inviting members of their constituents to come to their offices. So this goes back to something that we discussed about valuation in art. At that particular time, and we're talking in the 50s, the valuation of art was not the same as it was today, because even an insurance company could not afford to insure a Van Gogh collection and have it put in their offices. So this was really interesting. Yeah. This made a very, very deep impression on me. In fact, I still have the catalog from that show. And I went back to their offices. Again, I was a young man at that time, a young boy, but it made a deep impression on me and stuck with me ever since. And so that was kind of my initiation into the field of art.
Okay, interesting. And you studied art history, right?
I studied art history. I also got a doctor in philosophy and a doctor in religious science at York University in Canada. And later on, when the internet was starting, I did a fellowship at UCLA in computer science, just to understand kind of what the future was going to be holding for us.
Okay.
And I did a minor in art history at York as well.
Yeah, great. And
Have you heard about the instance from today, which happened in Paris? There was an old lady, no, it was a guy, damaging the Mona Lisa.
Yes, that was one of the first things I saw when I went online today, which is another topic as well, how the internet is influencing all of this information. But there was a young man who dressed up as an old woman, put himself in a wheelchair, wheeled himself to the front of the line for the Mona Lisa, and then jumped up, broke the glass on the Mona Lisa, and smeared cake on the painting as a protest for climate change.
Well, it's unbelievable. And that was not the first time that someone tried to damage it. And he was able to break the glass, which was a special glass.
Bulletproof glass.
Bulletproof glass, okay. In 2009, there was a Russian lady throwing a cup of tea to the painting, and the glass also broke. And in 1956, there was a Bolivian tourist throwing a stone at the painting after he watched it for hours. Yeah, so he damaged the painting the real way. So what I saw with these circulating short videos from the museum, there was a man trying to clean the Mona Lisa with a white cloth. Do you think it's a good idea to do it? I mean,
absolutely not.
Yeah.
First of all, I would not assume that the cake is pH balanced. So I would suggest that they probably should take it into a conservator and have that removed. Interestingly, the first time that I saw the Mona Lisa, many, many years ago, it was not behind glass.
Yeah.
And then years later, they decided to protect it behind glass, which makes it very difficult for viewing. And of course, you have everybody with their phones taking pictures of it. So what you see is the Mona Lisa with all of the cameras being reflected in the glass when you're trying to look at it.
Yeah.
So when you go back on the history of the Mona Lisa, remember there was a point where a workman actually stole the Mona Lisa and took it out of the gallery. And there is still some suggestion that the Mona Lisa that's in the Louvre may be a copy, and the original may be still in someone's private collection.
Do you know the value of this painting?
Well, there is no value attached to it. You know, it goes back to how we value art, but the Mona Lisa apparently is beyond value at this moment in time.
Yeah, I read it's the only painting existing which is not possible to evaluate.
Exactly.
This leads me to our today's topic, which is disruption as valuation. Let me quote Robert Huge. The price of a work of art is now part of its function. Its new job is to sit on the wall and get more expensive. Quote end.
Yeah, I love that quotation.
Yes, the quotation is wonderful. And Ken, when did art start to become an investment more than being a piece of art?
They suggested somewhere around 2005. Up to that point, and if we look at the history of art, especially when modern art was being coming to some importance, people did not buy the art with the idea that they were going to sell it and make money. They bought the art with the idea that this was something that was an important experience for them, and that over time they would create, I guess, a dialogue between themselves and the piece. And at that point, when people were selling art or updating their collections, they were doing it with a broader idea to develop a fuller voice for their collections. In fact, I was reading recently in Wall Street, they're not referring to art, they're referring to it as an asset level investment. It's now reached that stage where it's an asset level investment. So there's this expectation that is applied to art, and we're seeing that every day now on the internet, and especially what is happening in the last couple of years with NFTs. But it's interesting, I think, if you look for a definition of art right from the time of cave paintings to the release of the latest Madonna and Beeple collaboration. I guess the definition for art that makes sense is it's a measurement of values. Art is a measurement of values.
Yeah.
So that over time, our values towards that object have changed.
Yeah. Is it right that the people, when they gained trust into the market, into the artists, but also into the market? Am I right? Is this right?
Right. It's more about the market than the artist in a way. However, of course, the artist is producing, and producing it at a phenomenal scale. I don't think we've ever seen art being produced at the volume that is being produced today, even by individual artists. I went into Kuhn's studio.
Yeah.
And it's a manufacturing hub.
Yeah.
They're just churning out phenomenal amounts of art. And our expectation in the international market these days is you need an artist to produce at that level. The same with Damien Hirst, and, you know, there's dozens of them, Murakami, that's necessary for their evaluation and for their recognition to produce it at a huge level, because there's such a demand for it.
Yeah.
Now, in 200 years, we'll find out what the value of some of this is. But at the moment, we're looking at especially newer collectors who have a checklist. They need one Damien Hirst circle. They need two Jeff Koons dogs. They need two Warhol Marilyns. So there's a checklist. And instead of having collections that have an individual voice, they're becoming very uniform and somewhat bland when you look at these collections.
The checklist you were mentioning is definitely a U.S. checklist.
Oh.
I would say that the collectors from Europe, that they are different, that they collect in a different way. But it's very interesting to get to know it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, and they're slightly different whether you're talking about the Asian market or the European market, whether you've got Richters in your collection or Wends in your collection. But there seems to be more of a ubiquitousness to collections today than there have been in the past.
Yeah. Do you think by that we will lose art as we know it?
Well, art as we know it is always changing. And I think that is the thing that continually draws us towards art, because we are always looking for the disruptors. Throughout history, we see that the art that has started to gain attention has always started as just disrupting the art market. It has not been what we've expected it will be. When the Impressionists started to do their work, and Matisse, and people were aghast at what they were bringing to art. Same with the Dadaists. People were boycotting the shows, and now those are accepted as being important pieces of art.
Yeah.
Now we're looking at towards this new phenomena of the NFTs and trying to figure out how this is placing itself in terms of art history. And I don't think we've completely understood the value and the ultimate lineage of where this will be going.
Josef Beuys, he once said, everyone is an artist. Do you agree to this?
You know, I went to Dusseldorf when he was teaching at the Academy of Art, but I went to his free university because that's one of the main premises that he was using when he opened up Free University.
Yeah.
And he used to use that phrase a lot. Everybody's an artist. And I guess that starts to define what is an artist.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, everybody's had a different idea of what it is an artist. And Andy Warhol used to say the best art is business art. And he's sort of proved it in a way. When I was there, I had asked them that particular question as well, because that was a calling card for the free university. Everybody's an artist. Everybody should come here. Everybody can participate. And that begs the question again, what is art? And I think that everybody can be an artist, because an artist is someone who creates an original experience. So that can mean anything that goes beyond a person's daily practice. For example, an accountant, there are accountants who can do your taxes every day, but then there are accountants who have such a vision that they create a new insight into how figures can go together. And as you know, there are people in every profession that people say, yeah, he's a true artist in his profession. So in that way, in creating an original experience, people do have a possibility of reaching that level of being an artist in what they do.
Yeah.
But being recognized is something that's interesting too. Just recently, as of a few months ago, there was a fellow who was asked by his friend to come and help him clean out a barn in Connecticut. There was a whole bunch of things wrapped up in plastic, and they had already thrown out one dumpster's worth of stuff. And his friend came to help him out and realized that what was wrapped up in all of this so-called trash were actually paintings. So he said, rather than throw these out, let me take, there were, I think, two dumpsters full of paintings. He said, let me take these, and, you know, because I like some of them, and I can, he was a mechanic, he had a garage, he also had a skateboarding park. He said, I can hang them in my skateboarding park as decorations, whatever. So he took them, and his uncle, who was an amateur artist, saw a signature on one of these and said, let me do some research on it. And they did some research and realized that the work belonged to an artist by the name of Fred Hines. Hines had worked in New York as an artist who wrapped things, similar to Christo.
Yeah.
But Hines has been the only artist that's been able to wrap buildings in Manhattan. And at a certain point, he had quite a following. But he dropped out of the art business, and he decided he just wanted to continue doing his work. So he would work in his studio, and he would send his work up to this barn where he stored all of his work.
Wow.
So his work ended up having a perception at a certain point of no value. Luckily, this mechanic and his uncle were able to get hold of an art curator, and the art curator came in and started to do some research as well, and realized that Hines had some importance, and they connected him up to a gallery, and they've saved that. So again, the valuation of art really depends on where it's positioned and in society, and how it's measured in terms of the value of the time.
Yeah.
One of the other interesting phenomena of our time is the Salvador Mundi.
Absolutely, yes.
This piece that's still under controversy, whether this is a Da Vinci or not. I remember as it was brought to the museum and they decided to restore the piece, brought in and we had discussed possible buyers for the new work. And interestingly enough, there was a certain price attached to it.
Yeah.
However, they were very interested in positioning it in the right place, and the valuation varied considerably. I had some contacts in the Middle of the East that I thought might be interesting to place the piece with, and I talked to them. The Louvre was one of them. And unfortunately, at that particular time, they felt that would not be appropriate to have an icon of Jesus Christ in an area that was so heavily Muslim.
Okay, yeah.
And what we saw with the Salvador Mundi, it just kind of the intrigue sort of has remained attached to this piece, because the first, I guess, sale that it was made was to Abramovich.
Yeah.
And that was sold by Yves Bouvier, or Bouvier.
Yeah.
And I think there's still a lawsuit going on regarding that, because Yves did a tabletop sale on that where he brought in Abramovich. He was hired as his art consultant.
Yeah.
But he actually tipped the ownership into his name and then resold it to Abramovich at a much higher price.
Yeah.
And then
no good idea.
On top of that, he charged him his agent's fee, his commission.
Yeah, no good idea.
And which was legal, maybe not moral, but it was legal.
Yeah.
And then luckily, I guess for Abramovich, he put the piece up in auction, and it was sold to Mohammed bin Sulayman for $450 million.
Ah, that was him. Okay. Yeah. I just knew that it went to this area, but I didn't know who bought it. And now he's also not so happy.
Well, as it's been changing hands, there has not been a consensus with experts that it has been Da Vinci. And where it sits right now, there's still that consensus. They don't have total agreement. There's a lot of confusion about that. And also regarding the restoration, the person that did the restoration did a considerable amount of restoration. So that also begs a question on how far this is from the hand of Da Vinci, if it was from the hand of
It was a lady, right? Yeah. She made the restoration.
Yeah.
And as far as I understand, she did it a little bit too much.
Yes. I saw the piece through parts of the restoration and realizing that over the history of the piece, and that's something that's kind of interesting in terms of art, in terms of value too, the piece had been gifted to the King of England and then to the King of France, and each of them had their own idea of what they preferred in the piece, and they had their court painters paint things. For example, the English king wanted a blue background, so he had his court painter do a blue background on top of it. The French king, not to be outdone, wanted a green background, so he painted a green background. Final piece that we see today was very ethereal in nature. When the piece ended this travels and came to the buyer's hand before their restoration, they had made the eyes very definitive and really defined parts of the painting, so that as they were taking off the layers of all of these other artists, they realized that there wasn't the same type of detail that was in the original piece.
Yeah.
So, yes. So the Crown Prince has a $450 million something or other hanging there. Is it worth $450 million?
Yeah.
Is a question I don't think we know yet.
I think he will be the last owner of the work. And with all these stories.
I think so too. Ironically, the price that I was offering the painting for when I had it in my hands was considerably less. And there had been some suggestions now that he was considering donating it to one of these museums. They may or may not be interested because of all the controversy over the piece.
Oh my goodness.
So
imagine. Yeah. I remember there was this story, he wanted to have this work included in a very big museum's exhibition. Was it the Louvre?
Yes.
And they denied to add it to the collection, not to the collection, but to the exhibition.
Exactly.
Because that would prove the work as being a Da Vinci, but they are not in the situation to prove the works.
Exactly.
The proof should have been done before. Huh?
One of the Da Vinci experts does work at the Louvre, and they wanted to hang this side by side to the Mona Lisa.
Oh.
And that was refused.
Yeah.
They did, however, were able to get it into the National Portrait Gallery in London at one point, and they exhibited it there. And then there was an exhibit in Italy that was exhibited just around the piece, but it was more presentation about the piece, but that wasn't able to give it the credibility that suggested it was an original Da Vinci.
So what I have recognized while working in the secondary market for years, I also had the mandate to sell old masters. And what I found out, there's always part of the professions saying it's a real one. And there's always a part saying that studio, that means it was made by students of the master, but not from the master himself. So, and the old masters, they weren't signed at that time. So we also don't know by that. I also found it with Bacon. There's also a story. There's a group of professionals in the UK saying he's the only artist who never produced sketches. And then a boyfriend of Bacon, he got a complete huge collection of sketches of Bacon. And I've seen several with my own eyes. And I mean, I'm not able to verify if an artwork is false or it's a true one. But my feeling was, of course, it's a Bacon. But there were lawsuits, I think 4 at least. And they were said, yeah, they are not allowed to say anymore that they are not from Bacon. But there's also no one saying they are from Bacon. So,
yes, funny.
And the prices differ millions, millions.
Yes, I saw part some of those as well. And I often, too, remain in the same situation as you do, where we receive bulk of collections that are apparently attributed to this artist, that artist. You know, the stories vary that the original collector bought them directly from the studio, or they were a friend of the artist or whatever. But they are pieces that have not been recorded. They have not been exhibited. They're newer pieces for the artist in terms of being visible. And we have a responsibility to determine whether or not to bring those to our collectors. And my rule of thumb is to stay away from those that haven't been documented.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Because one never knows. Every year there seems to be another Jackson Pollock that someone found in his garage out in the Hamptons.
Yeah.
Well, there's that wonderful story that happened in the 80s and 90s in New York, where this woman in Long Island had a collector in Mexico who had this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful work of, he had Pollocks and Rothkos, and she would bring them to this gallery. And because these were work out of the studio, she would, that the gallery accepted them and sold for 15 years this continuous amount of work, until one day there was a collector who was looking at a work and saying, yeah, I know for a fact that that particular work wasn't a tribute to the artist. And they discovered, in fact, that the art was being created out in Queens by this Chinese artist who was extremely good at duplicating, making fakes, and was trying desperately to launch his own career, but couldn't afford, that people weren't interested in his own art, but he couldn't afford to produce his own art except for producing these other things. Now, they never determined whether he knew that he was producing fakes that were being sold at this level, or that he was just being producing reproductions, which is another thing that happens. People often will have someone produce reproductions for their house, their second house or whatever, or if they're going away from holidays and they don't want to leave the original work hanging.
Yeah.
So, you know, we see phenomenal amounts of work, which makes the market even more confusing. I've been offered so many Van Gogh haystack paintings that it would have been a lifetime work for Van Gogh to paint the amount of haystack paintings that are floating around. He wouldn't have time to paint anything else.
That was replicas which was offered to you?
The point that I saw them, they were fakes. I don't know whether the fellow who was painting them, because there was someone who was having him paint these things, I don't know if they told him that they were replicas that they were expecting him to paint, or he was in on the whole thing and understood that he was painting fakes.
Okay, yeah. In Germany, it's legally okay if you produce replicas after 70 years of the death of the painter, and then you are allowed to produce replicas and copies. But you need to write it down. You're not allowed to write the artist's name and sell them under his name, of course.
Yeah, there's one of the artists who used to work with Andy Warhol after his death. He took all the flower screens to make screen prints from. And you can, over on, in New Jersey right now, you can actually buy Andy Warhol reproduction flowers from him that are printed from the same screen using the same inks on the same paper or on canvas. But he sells them as replicas, not as original.
That's legally okay. Is this in America different, that the artist has to be dead?
Yeah, it's okay to produce a copy as long as you're selling it as a copy.
But you don't need to wait for 70 years?
No, you don't.
Ah, okay. Okay, it's interesting. Yeah, in Germany, it's not allowed to. You need to wait. I need to check all these super artists, like Bacon. I need to check the death, the time when they died. To order replicas. Ken, another question to get into the NFTs. In your eyes, where's the difference between art NFTs and gaming NFTs?
Well, I guess, you know, to understand NFTs is to go right back to the original. I mean, the NFT was developed, the correct name for it was ERC-721 standard. So they developed this standard as an interface for that allowed developers to take ownership of their data. So they created a standard to take ownership of data, and it has now morphed into a different type of business because there are so many levels of NFTs. For example, the contracts can have an NFT, and there's a certain value to having that because what the NFT does is it shows, it attaches ownership to a certain document. So as the document goes through different hands, you can see providence of the different hands that it goes through. So the big question is, are NFTs art? Is a bored ape or a gift of a sort of a pixelated punk art?
Yep.
And when video started to be more pervasive in the art market, there was the same question. Is where is the art in that? If there was a performance, is that one copy of the videotape, because videotape can be copied, is the original tape the piece of art, or is what you're watching, the experience of what you're watching, is that art? And we're sort of in that same spot right now. And it goes back to, you know, art is a measurement of values. There is pre-internet art, and then there is post-internet or internet art. And the internet has changed the way that we look at art. And I'm getting around to answering your question in a minute. Because even the way that galleries are presenting their work right now, and COVID had a lot to do with that too, because for a year or more, A lot of galleries weren't able to present their work as they had in the past, so they went onto the internet. So the experience of looking at art, of interacting with art, has changed dramatically in the last while. So are NFTs art, or if some can be art, what designates them as art? That's a question that we still are grappling with, because the NFTs became something that the value of whatever it was overwhelmed whatever that the unit of that piece was. People have been buying NFTs because, and it goes back to that original statement from Robert Hughes, people have been buying NFTs because they expected to increase the monetary value of what that asset was that they were holding. Now, we've seen in the last couple of months that the value in a lot of these things have changed dramatically. And also, we've also noticed that what has happened with NFTs, originally the value, one of the indicators for value was the fact that you could have a providence of ownership. And we've seen that there are people that have been able to take NFTs from one blockchain, put it on a different blockchain, and undercut the value. The people have been able to steal NFTs that way.
Yep.
So that's changed the value of it as well. And then people have been able to duplicate an NFT and sell it as an original, and that's questions the value of the original too. Art has always been about personal experience, and the value of the market right now seems to be the experience of expectations of increased monetary value rather than maybe, you know, a different type of valuation, which there has been in the past, which has been more about the experience, the interaction with art. There's also a fortunate part of it as well. The unfortunate things is, as we've been driving art onto the internet, the value of the personal experience interacting with the physical piece of the work has been lessened. And the value of expectations that if I buy a painting or a print or a sculpture online, is by the time it arrives at my door, it's going to be worth more than I paid for it. And part of that is this experience that people are having with the NFTs. A good example of that is this recent collaboration between Beeple and Madonna. Beeple, as you know, was able to bring a lot of attention because he sold his 5,000 NFTs in auction for around $69 million. So there was a lot of attention drawn to the fact that there could be a lot of evaluation attached to it. So lately, you know, he hooked up with, or Madonna hooked up with him to produce her outrageous presentation, which did not do very well in the market.
Oops.
I saw a quotation from a critic, Ben Davis, who said, "They actually went there? Whoa." As you might expect from Madonna, trying to push the boundaries of the experience, ended up being pretty crass in a way. And as I said, at the sale of it, it did not get the valuation that everybody expected. So, which kind of suggests something about there is no person in the NFT market who is a guarantee you're not going to, you know, now on Beeple doing this, had it sold for, you know, a considerable amount of money, Beeple would still be on that golden throne of being a person who understands how to introduce something and create a huge monetary value. So in terms of NFTs, we're still in the infancy. I'm always very supportive of you know, new experiences and new directions in art. And I think that eventually we're going to get to a point where there's going to be a way that we find something that maybe has more experiential value for the buyer, but I don't think we're quite there yet. We also have this other thing that's on the side called the metaverse.
Mm-hmm.
And people are saying, well, this is going to be the future of art. So you're able to buy all of these NFTs and hang them in your own gallery, and you can share your gallery and you can have people walk through the space in your own gallery. And this comes somewhat out of a gaming philosophy that you expect that experience inside is going to be a fulfilling experience. But recently, there have now been sexual assaults happening in the metaverse.
What?
So we have an uncontrolled environment right now. And this has been brought up to Zuckerberg because he'd open up the space. And how do you handle aggressive action? How do you monitor, control aggressive action in the metaverse? And that's one thing that people did not expect was going to happen.
Yeah.
But of course, we're all human and all of that is going to happen. So we're in the infancy of NFTs. Even in this whole idea of providence in terms of the NFTs, we're realizing that did not live up to the expectation that we thought it would. And what is the experience? And we're probably educating a new audience of collectors, because when you and I grew up, it was more important to actually interface with an actual piece. And now we're looking at the experience as being kind of immersed in an experiential landscape that sits on our computers.
What I think is the people will figure out where the quality is. From my point of view, an artist, a person who makes art, can only make art if he has, he or she or whatever, has something to say. And then the market will get back to normal.
Well, that's how we are accepting experiences. So that's the big change now, that there's different audience accepting a different experience. So being able to go online inside virtual environment seems to be an experience that people are accepting. I've seen, you know, people doing videos and using those as NFTs, which goes back to the early time when videotape was showing performances. And you're right, it's about how authentic and how original the experience is.
Yes.
If you can create an authentic, original experience, it shouldn't matter whether it's an NFT or a painting on the wall or a walk through the metaverse.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that's where we're looking for the artists that can do that. Just to do a gaming environment and hang things on the wall probably isn't enough. And even people like Beeple, when they were selling their NFTs, they were providing a complete experience. You got, not only did you buy the NFT, but you got a box in the mail, and the box had a little display thing, and it had several different things. So you got physical experience as well as the ownership of this little thing that existed online.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are out there just producing NFTs that don't have much of experience, that just have a little gift, and it's like, you know, buy my little penguin for $1 million, and you get a little penguin for $1 million. I think those things are going to be short-lived because they're not offering that much of a commitment and valued experience to the buyer.
Yeah. Thank you, Ken, for your experiences and for your words, for your ideas, and for taking the time to produce this podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Very enjoyable. And I enjoyed our years of talking about art.
Yeah. It's always very interesting. Thank you, Ken. Have a great day.
You too.
How is the art scene ticking? Everything we always wanted to know about art. This is the podcast of Petra Lossen.